The Guardian.
Anyone who uses the London Underground will recognise the monotonous tone of the robotic voice that tells us all to mind the gap.
Mind the gap between the train and the platform.
This is Sandbrook Grove.
Transport organisations around the world use similar systems, hoping that we will keep our eyes and ears open for long enough to avoid injury. But for some people, minding the gap is not so simple. If you're blind or deaf, you'll probably find it much harder to navigate. If you're a wheelchair user, you might have to wait for assistance in order to get over that gap and onto the train. And that's if you can even get to the platform in the first place. According to Transport for London, only 25% of tube stations and half of overground stations have step-free access. Solutions for people with disabilities can be incomplete, insufficient, and sometimes completely non-existent. Amputees can get prosthetics, but often only after a long and painful process. And even some recreational pastimes, like video games, can exclude those with disabilities because nobody thought to make them accessible. So, can technology help? Can machines or apps make life easier for a person with a disability?
A lot of times technology can enable so much. You know, for example, you say somebody in a wheelchair, somebody who hasn't got the strength to be able to open a door or something. This technology really, you know, could be life-changing.
And are these industries doing enough to make their products and the world accessible to all?
As with lots of tech for disabled people, it's still very elitist. It's expensive. To have a computer in an ankle is going to cost you thousands of pounds. And being in the UK and getting my legs from the NHS, seeing that trickle-down effect can be very slow.
Welcome to Chips with Everything. I'm Jordan Erica Webber.
Right, let me get the speaking rate down a little bit because it's quite fast.
65%. Wednesday the 14th of February. 60%. Press home to unlock.
Do you think people will understand that?
Why do you have it so fast?
Kevin Sitisabel is a musician and also works in digital marketing for a charity called Look UK. Kevin has been totally blind since birth. So the charity that you work for, Look UK, what is it and what does it do?
So yeah, Look UK supports young and partially sighted people. And basically, they have a mentoring program which matches visually impaired people with other partially sighted mentors, just because of the idea that if you're partially sighted, you've lived through similar experiences.
Given your vision impairment, what would you say is your biggest struggle in kind of day-to-day life?
I think probably traveling is really difficult. So if I don't know exactly where I'm going, it's always difficult navigating streets that I don't know. You know, maybe there are difficult crossings, or what if there isn't a pelican crossing or a traffic light? So I find that really difficult and often have to either rely on taxis to get around. But when I do sort of venture out on the roads, I find technology very helpful in terms of guiding me and showing me where to go.
Yeah, so how exactly does tech help you get around?
Yeah, so I've got iPhone, which has something called VoiceOver on it. It comes with all Apple products, and it basically is a screen reader. It reads what appears on my screen. So when I'm using an app like Blind Square, for example, the app tells me what's around, the names of the streets that I'm on. I can even track locations. So when I'm traveling down the road, I know exactly where I am and, you know, where I should be heading towards. And VoiceOver basically reads that information to me.
I could hear VoiceOver on Kevin's phone when he came into the studio, and I was fascinated. So I asked him to show me what it allows him to do.
So if I touch any icon on the screen with my finger, it will read out what's under my finger. So
voice memos.
If I touch the bottom left hand of my phone.
Doc. Messages.
Or the top or bottom.
Mail. 1,061 unread emails.
Oh, that's way too many emails. I do answer people, honestly. So then if I want to, you know, access one of the icons.
Just press record. Recently updated.
I double tap.
Double tap to open.
As it told me there. And then you go into the app.
Select it. Folders. New note. Button. Text field. Is editing. Insertion point at start.
Okay, so if I want to write, I basically sort of touch the letter that I need.
Cabbage. Hi.
So it can be quite slow, but obviously as I've typed on the phone a lot more, I've sort of began to learn where the letters are. But there is also what they call Braille screen input on the phone. So you can type as if you're using a Braille machine on the iPhone as well. And that sort of, so you type with six fingers to match the six Braille dots. So that's another cool invention that they have done.
Wow. And you know exactly where all of the keys are on the keyboard.
Yeah, well, roughly. but I can sometimes get it wrong. But yeah, roughly, I've sort of memorized all the positions. So when I first got an iPhone, it was really tricky to type. It took a while to do that.
So a lot of people get kind of predictive text mishaps where they type one thing and they get something completely other than what they meant. Does that happen to you as well?
Yeah, it happens a lot. And I use Dictate quite a bit. So where I tell Siri what I want to write. So you do get some very interesting mishaps sometimes. So I always have to make sure that I check what it's written to make sure that it hasn't misheard what I've said. But actually, it's quite handy.
So where does the voice come from? And did you get to choose that or would you prefer another one?
Yeah, so the voices come from Apple, and there are quite a few. There's some female voices, and also the voices that are used for Siri, you can also use the voiceover. I think, again, it's personal preference. It's kind of, I find it a bit disconcerting sometimes when I hear a voice that almost sounds human, but not quite human enough when it's reading things to me. So I find that a little bit disconcerting. So strangely enough, because I've got used to sort of robotic voices reading to me, it's, you know, that's something that I've got used to.
And you listen to it quite a lot faster than regular human speech. Why is that?
Just so I can get through stuff quicker, so I can read pages a lot quicker. Because one of the things is that I have to read text of pages in a quite linear fashion. You know, you can navigate by headings, for example, or list views, or buttons, which are really good navigators. But at the end of the day, you still have to read a lot more information. So being able to hear the speech faster means that I can get through web pages and documents a lot quicker.
Yeah, so obviously there have been solutions around for vision impaired people for a while. My grandma actually works with guide dogs, but has any of that been updated with technology for the modern age?
Not at the moment, I don't think, but I did read about that they're looking into ways that robotics could in future be guides. And for me, that would be really interesting because I used to have a guide dog years ago, but I almost felt like... you know, they have needs as well. And, you know, sometimes when, especially being a musician, I was out, you know, all day and then gigging in the evenings. I felt really sorry for the dog to sort of make them do a really long day's work, even though they are trained for that. So actually having a solution where, you know, I could have an electronic guide, like a robot guide, would be really cool for me, actually. So that would be hopefully something that gets developed in the future.
Have you been following developments at Boston Dynamics? People have been tweeting about this new robot that looks a bit like a dog and can open doors and how terrifying that is. But my friend Sam, who has cerebral palsy, said that for him it would be really helpful.
Yeah, I think that's something that, you know, a lot of times technology can enable so much. You know, for example, you say somebody in a wheelchair, somebody who hasn't got the strength to be able to open a door or something. This technology really, you know, could be life-changing.
Technology can be life-changing in other ways too.
So I'm Kat Hawkins and I'm a reporter at BBC Click and a double leg amputee.
Kat had her legs amputated below the knee after contracting meningitis 10 years ago at the age of 18. I asked her how far prosthetics for amputees have come.
It's amazing. When I go to the prosthetics hospital where I get my legs, there's a big board up on the wall and it traces the history of prosthetics. And you kind of look back to post-Second World War and they are rudimentary. They're made out of wood. They've got straps everywhere. I can't even
imagine what it must feel like to walk on something like that. So now they have advanced incredibly since those. So I have a carbon fiber socket. I have a pin lock. So I put a silicone liner over my stump and then a pin locks into the socket and keeps them on so it can't release until you press a button on the side. And then the feet that I use as well. I would say that these are actually fairly bog standard feet, but even in that they're made out of metal. There's a little bit of energy stored that can then give back a bit of movement to me. And compared to the old prosthetics, the wooden prosthetics, there's no comparison.
So you haven't been fitted with computerized prosthetics. Why is that?
So mostly the computers that you see in prosthetics are for above knee amputees. So the computerized components are normally the knee joints. There is incredible research and technology out there. So, for example, at MIT, there's a man called Hugh Herr, who is a double below-knee leg amputee himself, like me. And he lost his legs climbing. He got frostbite. And he has gone on to design these feet and calf muscle components. So in his ankle, and his ankle isn't even that much bigger than mine, you would hardly know the amount of technology that's in there. But there's a sensor, there's a motor, and there's an onboard computer. So when he's stepping down, the sensor senses how much energy he's putting into his foot. And then the motor component takes that energy and gives him some more release. And then the computer element senses what's coming next. What kind of step does he need to take? So when he literally runs upstairs, his ankles are moving as anybody's ankle with legs would move. And seeing that, honestly, when I watched his TED talk, it blew my mind. The level of technology and research, and coming from a disabled man himself with the experience of what he wanted to see, that is exciting. But as with lots of tech for disabled people, it's still very elitist. It's expensive. To have a computer in an ankle is going to cost you thousands of pounds. And being in the UK and getting my legs from the NHS, seeing that trickle-down effect can be very slow. So while it's exciting, we still need to see that progression in terms of people getting access to that kind of prosthetic.
So how far away are we from a kind of perfect utopian future where anyone with an amputation or with a disability has the perfect tech solution that gets them feeling the way they were before?
Yeah, you can get very excited, especially when you love tech in the way that I love tech, and also you love prosthetics in the way that I love prosthetics. But actually, I think it is important to notice the reality of the situation. And that reality is that most people are probably decades away from even trying that, let alone getting funding for it. We're seeing changes happen. So governments are beginning to fund prosthetics in a way that, in the Western world at least, in a way that we've not seen before. The Paralympic Games, I think, really incentivized people to look at disability in a different way and also be excited about it in a tech way. And so begin to research more. And so it's not just disabled people themselves that are now seeing how important this work is. But academics are getting excited about it, which is what we need. We need everybody to see the potential for disabled people in terms of giving back independence and allowing people to navigate what is a really inaccessible world in a way that they haven't been able to previously. And that's the most important thing.
You've been able to experiment with lots of different kinds of prosthetics though, haven't you? So those who follow you on Twitter will have seen some of your videos. Some of them are made for very specific purposes. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so I'm very lucky. As part of my job, I have managed to try out some very fun things. So recently I went and tried out some feet that are specifically designed for snowboarding and skiing. And it was amazing, like putting them on for the first time. My feet really are stuck at a right angle. And the impact of that is huge, because if you imagine you've got a stump for one, and then you've got a foot that is stuck at a right angle. So walking upstairs every day,
and downstairs. That jolting impact is massive. Whereas these snowboarding feet, as soon as I stood up on them, they've got this piston in them and I could move my feet forward. I could go onto what would be my tippy toes and push down in that as if I had calf muscles back. And that sensation I hadn't felt in the 10 years since being an amputee, since having my legs and feet. So it set my nerves a little bit strange, but that movement, it didn't make me a good snowboarder though. I still fell over a lot.
So the tech industry is moving in the right direction, but is it moving fast enough? And what still needs to change to achieve true accessibility? After the break, we'll hear from Ian Hamilton, an accessibility expert in video games. He'll explain why accessibility is so important in his industry.
Games being accessible is important because games are important.
Kat and Kevin will also tell us what new technology they would like to see that would make a huge difference to them.
Taking those and putting it into technology in order to achieve that real high level movement that feels human, that is amazing. Like that potential for me is exciting.
Don't go anywhere, we'll be right back.
Welcome to The Start, a brand new weekly podcast from The Guardian.
Without those kind of engaging with reality, I will not become Ivory today.
Each episode reveals a story of artistic beginnings, as told by some of the great artists of our time.
For me, Scandalicious, so much of that was also about me finding my way.
Focusing on one piece, they share how these early moments of creativity shaped them, the influence it had on their subsequent work, and what the piece now means to them in retrospect.
The most I've ever seen in any room, you know, looking at any kind of art, was in Mr. Barnes's two rooms.
To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search The Start on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back to Chips with Everything. I'm Jordan Erica Weber. Before the break, we explored some of the ways in which the technology industry has helped to make the world more accessible for people with disabilities. Kevin Satisabel and Kat Hawkins told us about the challenges they face with their respective disabilities and how technology has helped them to adapt. One industry close to my heart has recently taken much more of an interest in accessibility: video games. And do you have a disability yourself?
I don't know, just the usual stuff that comes with pushing 40.
Ian Hamilton is an accessibility expert who works with video game developers to help make their games more widely usable by people with impairments. He isn't disabled, but he has spent the last 10 years focusing on making video games more accessible for people who are. But why?
Well, it was kind of a multi-step process. So the first thing really came about when I was working for the BBC on their children's content. So CBeeby stuff like Teletubbies and that kind of thing. While I was there, I saw some playtesting footage of CBeeby's games that had been adapted to work with a single key press. And the reason why this had been done was because basically a key press can be mapped to other devices. So it can be mapped to a button on the wheelchair headrest, or it can be mapped to a tube to blow into. It's basically Stephen Hawking kind of tech. And when I was at school myself, I'd done an exchange program with a special education school, and I'd seen kids with that kind of level of disability who were basically kind of sat at the back of the classroom just being cared for, passive participants. And what I was seeing here through a relatively simple design decision in the game was actually these kids taking part as equals, laughing, smiling, playing, doing the same stuff as all their classmates. So it was quite hard to see something like that and not be inspired about the kind of life-changing potential that the medium has got. So that was kind of the first stage. And then the next stage really came a few years further down the line when my career had progressed a little bit further and I was overseeing lots of different games coming in from different companies at publisher level. and seeing all these companies putting so much effort into polishing some little bit of their game to make it that little bit more fun, at the same time as making their game a miserable experience for huge swathes of players through, for example, using red and green to differentiate things or not having very good contrast, not for any good reason at all, just because of lack of awareness. So that's kind of what got me interested in trying to fix that problem, basically trying to spread a bit of knowledge.
And what kind of progress has been made in that time in the games industry specifically?
Even if you just go back a few years ago, where the industry is now is just incomparable. So if you just take, for example, a single feature, colorblindness, it's pretty common now to see games that take colorblindness into account. It was only going back as far as, you know, like 2014, that it was really, really rare. It wasn't until you started to get a few examples of big name games like SimCity, like Black Ops 2, like Borderlands 2, to start taking into account that actually it started to snowball. And just the kind of things now, like as of, I think a few months ago, every single major gaming platform has got built-in accessibility features designed specifically for people with disabilities. And even going back just, you know, to 2-3 years ago, that would have been pure science fiction. So the industry's still got a long, long way to go, but certainly compared to where it was even 5 years ago, let alone 10 years ago, it's just immeasurable progress.
So presumably the work is not all done and there's still some way to go. What still needs to change in the industry?
So I think you've already covered this a bit with speaking to Kevin, how blind accessibility works. So basically there's an external piece of software called a screen reader that analyzes the interface and speaks it out. And at the moment, it doesn't really work with most games because the coding frameworks that game developers often use to build games don't work with it. And it's a real shame, especially on a platform like iOS, where you've got just thousands of games that would be perfectly suited to blind accessibility. Even the big name ones, basically anything interface-based from Football Manager to Hearthstone would be perfect for blind accessibility for a really small amount of work. But there's just this wholly unnecessary technical barrier in the way. So if that one little technical barrier could be fixed, it would mean huge, huge things for blind accessibility.
So kind of philosophically speaking, why is it so important that video games be more accessible?
Well, games being accessible is important because games are important. There's all kinds of reasons why it's important, but two really, really big ones. One is from the developer side, the business case. Games are a $100 billion industry, and people with disabilities, even if you go by official government figures, account for 20% of the population. Not everyone within that 20% is going to come up against barriers in games, but there's also other conditions that aren't covered by that 20%. Things like colorblindness, which affects 8% of males. Difficulty reading, which affects 14% of adults, and both those things can come up against all kinds of unnecessary barriers. The other side to it is slightly less mercenary, which is the human side of it, the human benefit, the difference it actually makes to people. Because what games actually represent is access to culture, to recreation, to socializing, which are things that a lot of people will take for granted, but if for any reason your ability to access those things in day-to-day life is restricted, then games can all of a sudden become a huge, huge contributor to people's quality of life.
Have you got a personal wish list for new developments for leg amputees? Is there anything you'd really like to see?
So before I had my legs amputated, I was a dancer, and that was my love. I wanted to be a dancer. And so that actually was the hardest bit for me, becoming an amputee, was losing that ability to move and cover great distances quickly and really feel in control of my own body. And I haven't really managed to achieve that since being an amputee. So people like Hugh Herr, who are looking at using sensors and using robotic components and animatronics and looking at how the human body really works. How can we learn from animals and the way that their bodies really work? Taking those and putting it into technology in order to achieve that real high level movement that feels human, that is amazing. Like, that potential for me is exciting.
That technologies are starting to really think about accessibility, I think, but not all of them are. And I still think there's a long way for things to be made fully accessible. I think a lot of people are thinking about accessibility as something that they should do rather than something that they have to do. I mean, if accessibility is sort of as integral to the design of the app, as integral to the visuals, you know, of an app, then that's where accessibility will really change and be inclusive for everyone.
I'd like to thank Kevin Satisabel, Kat Hawkins, and Ian Hamilton for chatting with me this week. You can find links to Look UK, BBC Click, and the Game Accessibility Guidelines in the description for this episode on the Guardian website. If you have any questions, queries, or feedback, get in touch via our email address, guardianchips@gmail.com. And please let us know if you have any cool digital stories you think we should know about. I'm Jordan Erica Weber. See you next time.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.